that God holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as unworthy of nothing else but to be cast into fire. You are 10,000 times so abominable in his eyes as the most hateful and venomous serpent in ours. There is laid in the very nature of carnal men a foundation for the torments of hell.
This quote from Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, evokes both sadness and anger as it fails spectacularly to reflect the loving heart of God and the inherent value placed upon God's creation. Perhaps no modern church dogma has been more destructive to the mission of Jesus, created more atheists, or generated more religious trauma than that of eternal conscious torment for the non-believer. This podcast's aim is to bring together experts in their fields to take the listener on a historical, philosophical, and theological journey to deconstruct this harmful doctrine. Along the way, the listener will not only be offered pathways to reconstruct a compelling perspective of final punishment, but ways to heal and move beyond the dire impact of eternal conscious torment indoctrination. Thank you for listening as you join us in our journey, the journey towards deconstructing hell. Hello, friends, and welcome to the Deconstructing Hell podcast. This podcast mini-series has been created as a companion to the book by the same title, Deconstructing Hell, Open and Relational Responses to the Doctrine of Eternal Conscious Torment, that was edited by Chad Ball and published by Sacrisage Press. The show is also brought to you in partnership with the Rethinking Faith podcast, hosted by yours truly, Josh Patterson. And today I am privileged to be joined by the author behind chapter 10 of Deconstructing Hell. Their title is chaptered Inescapably Ingrained: How Western Culture Perpetuates the Everlasting Torment View of Hell. And that author's name is Sean Ryan. Sean, how are you doing today?
Oh, good. Great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to get to chat with you. Our paths haven't crossed much, you know, in the past. Yeah. So I'm excited for this conversation.
It's just been interesting because you don't know me, but I feel like I know you because I've listened to your podcast so often. It's one of my favorites. I'm always looking for the new episode. So.
Oh, cool. Well, that's exciting. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Sean, the one way that, you know, during this Deconstructing Hell podcast, I think that could be helpful for our listeners is just kind of to introduce our authors. And so maybe if you would, could you just kind of give our listeners a little bit of background about who is Sean Ryan and what kind of things might you find yourself doing?
Okay, well, it's interesting because you know, I'm different than probably most of the authors on there, yourself included. I did not grow up attending church on a regular basis. I did occasionally with some friends. I lived in a small town. Wintertime, sometimes that was the only thing to do. They'd let me play on the softball team, so during the summer I might spend a couple times there too. But for the most part, I really wasn't a regular attender. And by the time I was in high school, I wouldn't say that truly inside I felt like I was an atheist, but I acted as if I was one. I always kind of felt there was still a creator out there. But jump forward many, many years, and my wife still wanted to kind of go get back into church and, you know, asked me if I would go with her. And I said, oh, absolutely. You know, you're my wife. So we tried a few different places and they just weren't resonating with me. So I stayed home on Sunday mornings. Well, she comes back one Sunday and says, hey, you know, this one church we tried before, they got a new pastor. I think you'll like this guy a lot. You know, would you give it another try? Sure. Well, he kind of floored me that day with his sermon. He said some things I'd never heard a pastor say before. He let me ask questions, and in his responses, he told me my questions were tough and he couldn't answer them, which was also something I'd never heard before from a pastor. It was always, oh, go read this verse, or, you know, where is your faith lie? And, you know, just giving me all sorts of other reasoning. About the same time all that was going on, I actually went back to school to finish a degree I'd started many years earlier, and it was in history, European history. Well, if you think much about European history, particularly any time from the Middle Ages up through the Renaissance, it's basically a lot of church history. So I'm going to church while I'm taking these classes. A buddy of mine that I went to high school with that I hadn't seen for years connected with me, asked me if he could send me this book to read. And it was happened to be Letters of the Skeptic by Greg Boyd. And I'm a great book. So all these things kind of happened at once, and I'm still kind of, you know, questioning things. And, you know, I'm not one to say God moments, which is common, but I don't know what else to call this, where I kept having Psalm 46:10 appear to me, which is, be still and know that I am God. It would just, wherever I'd be in different places, and I'd see a sign somewhere, or it'd be on the movie in the background, and it just kept hitting me. And I thought, okay, well, maybe this is a sign that I just need to chill out, quit with my questions for a little bit, and just recognize that there's something greater in this world than me. And then through all that, I finished my degree in history and thought, well, I kind of like this theology stuff. So I went and got a master's degree in theology. So I haven't done anything with it. This writing experience that Chad invited me to do is the first time I've ever written anything. For publication anyway. I've talked about it and had the ideas before. In fact, I've had two or three different books floating around in my head for a long time. One of them I really got kind of into, but I was still slow. And someone else who you know of beat me to the punch and actually done a much better job than I would have. And that was Bruce Epperly's Running with Elephants. The concept of that book was a very similar concept to what I had looking at other faiths and how they relate to open and relational theism. But I was very, very slow at it, slow at the research, slow at doing things. And all of a sudden this book comes out and I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm not going to go there now. I don't want to feel like I'm still in his thunder. So, it's been fun. You know, we've had the Facebook group now. So kind of connecting with people there. There was a call last night that Chad was a part of that he hosted and kind of gave a rundown. So I participated in that. It's been a good time. It's been a good experience, and getting to meet a lot of new people.
Yeah, sweet. I dig it. I love starting with that question just because I think it, you know, I say this all the time on the podcast, and, you know, Rob Bell says that joy has no shame in repeating itself. So I'm going to repeat it as much as possible. But I think story is just powerful. And I mean, even looking back when I think about growing up in church like I did, I don't remember the sermons that the pastors preached, but I do remember many of the stories that they told. And so I love asking people these kind of questions, you know, just to kind of see.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because that's actually what the sermon was that got me kind of hooked, was it was a story. He was telling a story about how he got invited to this party and he accepted, but then all of a sudden he started getting calls from people saying, I'm not sure you want to go to that party. It's like, why not? Well, you know, the people probably be smoking and cussing and there might be some drinking. And he's like, why is that going to stop me? And when he said that, I'm like, whoa, okay. He's just a person too, right? He's just a person. And he's not going to put those people to shame because they're doing something that someone else who's holier than thou thinks they shouldn't be doing, right? So I really appreciated that from
him. Yeah, cool. Well, in light of that then, I'm interested. I'm asking all the authors, when Chad first reached out to you, why was it that you said, you know what, Deconstructing Hell sounds like something I want to be a part of? Like, what was kind of your motivation behind wanting to join this project?
Well, it was interesting because Chad and I barely even knew each other. We connected through all of our good friend Tom Ward. Tom had sent or told me that you know, I might want to read Chad's book, God Unbound. So I did, and I wrote just a little review of it, and that got Chad and I kind of communicating back and forth. And in those conversations, I told him I had desires to write at some point, but I just really hadn't been able to do it. So when he asked me, I was humbled and honored that he, you know, said, "Hey, you want to give this a shot?" So even though I already felt the things that I wrote about, and I felt the strong movement away from eternal conscious torment, I really honestly accepted because he had that faith in me that I could do it. And it gave me that little nudge to actually put myself out there a little bit.
Well, shout out to Chad, because we all need that little push every once in a while. Speaking from experience, I tend to have to lack confidence in these kind of regards, which I've, you know, I've talked about a little bit before. But anyway, shout out to Chad for giving that push. I personally enjoyed your chapter, and I have one more question before we hop into it, but I think you brought like a very unique angle that I hadn't really like thought about before, to the book. So I'm excited to jump in there. But one more thing I just wanted to ask you, just kind of as like some background information. And I know you said that you didn't like really grow up in church, but growing up, what was your experience of hell? And this might actually serve as like a nice segue into your chapter, depending on how you might answer.
You know, thinking back on it, the times that I went to church, I don't really remember it being preached much. But if I ask questions, kind of that the very common view, the ECT view, would be something that came out. But honestly, I think I was sort of shaped my view by the things I wrote about, the music and movies and everything. I've always been kind of a horror flick kind of guy. Horror and sci-fi, those are my two things. And so, you know, I've watched countless movies that, you know, opening the gates of hell and things like that. So those were always in my head. But as I matured, I also thought, well, this just doesn't make sense. I mean, it really just doesn't make sense. This God's supposed to be all loving, and he's going to torment people for eternity. It just was illogical to me. And that's in part why I'd say in my teenage years that I kind of was like, yeah, forget it. Forget this whole Christianity stuff. Because up to that point, I, you know, even though I didn't grow up in church, I think I still considered myself a Christian. You know, I live in rural Indiana, where it probably, if there was a poll done here, it's going to be 90%+ is going to identify as Christian. You know, there's still do Christmas pageants and programs and stuff at school. So it's always been around me. So I always kind of, I guess to put it in a context, I would call myself a cultural Christian. I wasn't really devoted to it, but because of where I lived and my surroundings, I still considered myself part of that.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And I mean, this is a whole other tangent we have to go into, but the whole idea of like cultural Christianity and like looking at the political landscape currently and how different like people who identify more so as cultural Christians fall in a variety of spaces is just really interesting. I'm not going to make any like points or comments about that, more so like, hey, listeners, if you're interested, Google it, you'll figure it out. Right. I'm more interested in talking about the chapter that you contributed to Deconstructing Hell, which again, listeners, was chapter 10. And it was titled Inescapably Ingrained, How Western Culture Perpetuates the Everlasting Torment View of Hell. And what, Sean, I think you did so well was just kind of, I don't know. I think I love unique things. And I think you came at this topic from a very unique perspective, in that like you weren't necessarily just trying to argue you know, from a theological or biblical or philosophical, but rather like, hey, culturally, this is a thing in the air. And of course, theology and philosophy, these kind of things inform your opinion. I'm not saying like, you know, you don't do any of that. I'm just saying like, I love the angle that you kind of took. And so what I did was I just kind of took some like bullet points as I reread your chapter, some key things that maybe might be fun to kind of talk about. But one thing that you kind of lead off the chapter with was this idea that the idea of eternal conscious torment or a fiery place of suffering is something that sells very well within a capitalistic society. And so I'm interested, could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Okay, well, I guess that's probably letting some of my own political leanings shine through there. But, you know, most of the Western world has some sort of capitalism, but American capitalism is a little bit different. I think we are truly about making the next buck, no matter what it takes to do that. That's why we have issues with healthcare and insurance companies, because it's all about making money. It's not about actually taking care of people. So with that said, you know, these ideas and these depictions of hell, they are interesting. They can cause fear. They can cause anxiety. So people actually want to learn about them, maybe from the opposite way. How do I stay away from that? Right. So they're going to learn as much as they can. Well, you got people out there marketing this thinking, well, I'll just make money off this interest and I'll feed it to them. You have others who think that it might be silly. So they go the other way. I don't know if I mentioned Slayer or not in the band, but or in the article, but the band Slayer had an album, and believe it or not, it was released on September 11th, 2001, and it was called God Hates Us All. And when they were kind of asked about it, I don't remember which member, but he replied that, you know, it's not really about God hating us all. It's we all will have those days that are bad, horrible, and we'll say, oh, God must hate me. Well, guess what? It happens to all of us. God hates us all. And so they do it more tongue in cheek. They're kind of like, you know, the artwork, do a lot of artwork on their album covers, you know, songs called South of Heaven. You know, what is that telling you, right? And then you have even, you know, I know I did mention AC/DC, but that's one that I grew up listening to. Friends and family members, you know, I can remember when I was real little pretending I was Angus Young and trying to play guitar and, you know, but that whole persona that they gave, you know, album called Highway to Hell, songs called Highway to Hell, Hell's Bells, Hell Ain't a Bad Place to Be, you know, it got people interested. And you got the people who also felt like they were rebels by doing that, right? Oh, hey, I want to be with those guys. You know, they're rebels. So I'm going to spend the money on buying their albums, buying their t-shirts, going to their concerts. It sells. It sells. And then, you know, and that's just music. You got the movie industry as well, which I kind of already mentioned growing up watching horror movies. But I also put in the chapter there that it's in animated shows. I mean, so our kids, I was a kid watching these things and it just kind of seeping into your head. And so kids today are going through that same thing. It's you almost don't question it because it becomes so commonplace. You just think that's just the way it is.
Yeah. And I resonate with that so deeply because so like I love heavier styles of music. And so like, you know, that this theme of like hell or something like that's kind of like a common trope within some of this heavier music. So like that very much has been an influence, but even just, you know, when you're talking about like TV shows, you know, like in the book, you mentioned like Tom and Jerry and the Simpsons and the Flintstones and Disney movies, with all like the, you know, the silly common tropes of like, you know, Satan with the red pitchfork and fire and that kind of stuff. But just like, A practical example that comes to mind as well, on top of those is, when I was, so I was a high school pastor, youth pastor, I don't know. I worked with students at a Methodist church at one point in my life. And I remember having students, they were watching the TV show called Lucifer. A pretty, it's a pretty good show. Like my wife and I have watched it. It's definitely entertaining, but I would have students come in to youth group after watching Lucifer and ask questions as if Lucifer was portraying theological truth or was like actually like this is what is in the Bible. And I was like, guys, it's a TV show. It's not. So like that was just like a practical. I remember that experience and being like, holy crap, like this TV show, which in my mind is like, obviously it's a TV show. It's meant for entertainment, but my students didn't see it that way. And so I think this point that you're making is really, really important because, I mean, I've seen it personally. It's influenced me and also students that I have worked with.
Yeah. And unless you have studied and learned on your own, you don't think as much about it. It just becomes unconscious, that planted in your head. And so when you see these things, you don't really question anymore. You just think that's the norm. This traditional view is just the way it is. But once you, I think, start to really just ask yourself, read scripture, search and look for alternative things, you'll realize, wow, there's a lot of issues with this traditional view.
Yeah, big time. And one other point that I think you kind of really drive home in the chapter is you start quoting research, which is always a good idea. And so I just want to read briefly two of the quotes about in referencing Pew Research that you mentioned in regards to this kind of cultural perception, because it was really, I mean, shocking to me. And you said in 2014, Pew Research found that 3% of atheists, 9% of agnostics, and 36% of the nothing in particular group all believe in hell, including 22% that say religion is not important. And you also go on to say that another Pew Research study completed in 2021 showed that 62%, which is up from 58% in 2014, of all U.S. adults believe in the existence of hell, with evangelical Christians having the highest percentage at 91%, and that belief in hell flows across the Western world, making it not only a religious perspective, but again, a cultural one. And I think this research like kind of really drives home the point that you're making within your chapter.
Yeah, and the last figure in that, the 91% for evangelical Christians, was not a shock to me. 3% of atheists, 9% of agnostic. That was a shock. I'm thinking, you don't even believe that there is any kind of deity, but yet you believe there is this place of torment and punishment. I can't wrap my mind around it other than it's been ingrained in them through their cultural surroundings. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I don't know. I think it's so interesting to me because even talking, all right, so for example, being in the like, so I'm a brewer now, I make beer,
love it.
And and so like talking to I think even yesterday I was joking with a colleague of mine that I think people's like the common view of hell is silly. You know, we were in the cold box, the walk-in cooler, and I was like, yeah, dude, I think people who think hell is like super hot and like there's fire and stuff, that's not for me. Like if I was in hell, I would be outside in a snowstorm. It'd be freezing cold. I'd be naked and I'd be like shoveling snow to like clear the driveway. And like, if I could clear the driveway, I could go inside, but it's snowing so hard, I can never keep up. And like, even making that joke to my coworker, who in their own words are agnostic at best, they felt uncomfortable because they're like, well, I know you used to be a pastor. Like, are you allowed to, is that okay? can you say these kind of things? So even for my coworker who is not religious, did not grow up as a Christian, is agnostic at best, they were uncomfortable with the idea that I was like, maybe hell is cold. 'Cause hot sounds nice. Like, I want to be on a beach with some palm trees. I don't know. So I think it just, it goes to your point.
Yeah, it does. I was going to say, that's the point exactly right there. And I really can't think of anyone that I've ever just had any kind of casual conversation with where the topic has come up in some fashion that didn't just naturally believe it that way. That it was, you know, fire and brimstone.
Yeah. Man, which sucks. But within your chapter, you do end up taking a turn that I think is really interesting, because I noticed this. Keith, so I interviewed Keith Giles as well recently, actually last mm-hmm. night. And he makes a kind of a similar turn in his chapter. He uses slightly different words, but you kind of talk about this core principle of love. And then kind of shift the conversation and say, maybe instead of thinking, you know, when we think about hell, maybe we should filter it through this idea of love. When you talk about that, what do you mean by that? And why is that important to you?
You know, it's weird. Part of the reason that, I don't even know why I connected with Tom Ward years ago, but part of what kept me coming was his research and his books on the idea of love. I've learned so much from him. I am horrible at providing love the way it should be, but that's something I think about a lot and I strive for. And in that mindset, you know, if you just use the scriptural definitions of love, you know, love is patient, love is kind, right? That doesn't sound like someone who would want to send someone to eternal conscious torment. You know, we can't even really truly grasp the idea of eternal. I mean, we are finite beings. We, you know, have some probably vague memories of when we were real little, but probably not till early elementary that memories really start kind of growing and sticking with us. We know that we are going to expire at some point. So to think of eternity, that's something I don't think our brains can truly understand. And to me, there's nothing, right? I've said this to people, and they've asked the Hitler question to me. You know, I'm like, I can't think of anything anyone could do in their average lifespan of 70, 80 years that would be worth eternal conscious torment. And I'll get, well, what about Hitler? Hitler too. I mean, I still don't think that warrants that. And I do not believe a loving God would go that route. I'm not saying there's not any kind of punishment. I mean, there very well could be punishment. I just don't think it's this eternal conscious torment. And I think that when we think about hell, we have to keep that in mind. We have to keep that idea of love in mind. If we believe what John tells us and that God is love, right? I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's a very direct statement. God is love. And then we take these biblical definitions of love. And, you know, if you go as far as Tom does and breaks down the different versions of the word and the Greek and the Hebrew, you'll see, you come to the conclusion that you can't have eternal conscious torment and God be love. You can't, you know, and I'll admit, I'm not one to always use scripture as my support. But that's what people will for the other side of the argument. So you have to go back to it to refute it. And I think it's in plain sight. If you want to actually really, truly read about it, it's in plain sight that there's no way there's eternal conscious torment. Now, what the ultimate conclusion is, I don't know, right? You know, I don't know if it's universalism. I don't know if it's annihilationism. I don't know. My gut tells me that for those that don't want to accept God, that when they die, they're gone. It's like they were never born. My hope, though, is universal reconciliation. I would love to see, you know, everyone come to that and fall into that love and the love of God and the love of each other. That's my hope. My gut just doesn't believe it.
I dig it. I appreciate the honesty, because I feel like that's perhaps the case for a lot of people. Even perhaps for myself, I kind of fall within the, general umbrella of ultimate reconciliation. But I nuance it very heavily and use a bunch of nerdy, metaphysics and boring process philosophy stuff. I think it's an honest position to kind of hold, but I love the hope. Cause I think, what I used to, when I would work with students and they would ask me this question, I would, instead of giving them my answer, I would offer three main perspectives kind of, and then say, here's, what the church, our church teaches, here's what, what the head pastor Mark probably thinks, here's my opinion. But at, ultimately, I hope that God is, to steal language from Trip Fuller, that God is at least as nice as Jesus. Then I can kind of lean into that.
I agree with you there too, because I did write in the chapter that I think we should still teach it, but I think it should be teached in conjunction with other views, and let people make up their own mind. Let them do the research and come to their own conclusion, instead of just forcing something on them, saying, hey, this is what this group of people believe. Here's why they believe it. But here's what this group does. And here's what this group does. And let them kind of work it out themselves. I think that it's more fulfilling, more fruitful, if people can kind of come to those things on their own without just being force-fed.
Yeah. 100%. And I think kind of tying into this whole conversation, you have this interesting bit within your chapter where you kind of differentiate between faith and belief, and kind of talk about fear-based systems. And one thing that, myself and my former co-host on Rethinking Faith, Greg, talk about is we kind of reject fear-based systems outright, just because we're I don't know. Don't have time for that anymore. But so I'm curious, any comments on the fear-based stuff, but also the differentiation between faith and belief, and perhaaps why that matters to you.
Okay. Faith, first of all, I guess that's a kind of hard one to answer. I hadn't thought about putting that in words, but, because I had been asked before, well, what role does faith play in your belief? And I was like, to me, they are kind of two different things. I can think of faith in a couple different ways. One is just a more general sense of your religious persuasion. You are of the Christian faith, you are of the Muslim faith, that type of thing. But I also think it is how we, I guess, perceive our deity, our God, and putting that belief in him, that regardless of whatever else comes about, I'm still going to put my trust there. That's a faith. But I don't know if faith is something that you can choose or not. It sounds maybe difficult to explain, but I just don't know if it's something you can choose. So what you do have is belief. And I think belief is a choice. You may, it's like we've probably heard the phrase before, the statement that love is a choice, right? You choose to love people, right? Marriage is a choice to continue to love each other, even in the presence of tough times, right? You have that belief. And I think that's just the same way. I think that's kind of maybe, probably not explain the nuance very well, but I think that's the difference between them. Is faith is something that you just intuitively feel, I guess, and belief is a choice. And so, like, for me, what I intuitively felt was there was a deed, there was a creator. I look at the world and I just, you know, yes, okay, it's argument by design, but I don't know how else to say it. I look outside my window and I think there's no way that this just happened. And it's been, I don't know how long ago now, but we were on a family vacation and we went to, it was a planetarium and there was a, it was a documentary hosted by Liam Neeson that was kind of, you know, you're sitting back in a planetarium and it's all above you. And he's talking about the creation of Earth, the things it takes to create Earth. And as he's going through it, I'm thinking then there's no way. If it takes all of these things for life to actually come about, there's no way it was just an accident. You know, it got in upwards of like 200 different things that would actually have to happen for life to take place. And, you know, that was a defining moment for me too. I was just like, oh, okay. So what I have felt by looking at the world has just been validated by Liam Neeson and his nice Irish accent, you know, telling me that, yeah, you know, and it wasn't a religious documentary. It wasn't trying to push anything out. It really was true scientific. But for me, it was a validation of something that my gut already told me. And that was something that I had faith in. So that's where they would probably tie together, faith and belief, is that's something that I felt. I chose to believe it, and that kind of tied them together. Seeing the science aspect with something that I felt in my heart brought it all together. I don't know if I kind of answered the question out there. It was a tough one. I just never really thought to explain the difference between them before. So I hope I done okay.
Yeah, no, I dig it. I like it. I like it. I think for me, like, one metaphor that I've tried to use with students when I would teach, and it fits very nicely with what you're saying, and is that, like, I would, you know, hint at the fact I'm a big ice hockey fan. I love the Washington Capitals, and this year would be a perfect example.
Let me have you pause for a second, because okay. You used to ask that of your guest.
I did.
Yeah, you used to ask that of your guest, and I would always envision myself, well, I'm going to be a guest on there one day. I know I will. And I'm going to tell him, I don't care about hockey. Let's talk about baseball.
Ah, there we go. All right. No, that's good. That's good. My former boss, Dan Baumiller, at Full Tilt, loves baseball. And, like, he would always bust on me and be like, Josh, no one cares about hockey. Like, baseball is way better, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah. So briefly, who's your baseball team? Who do you like?
St. Louis Cardinals. Even though I live in kind of north central Indiana, my mother was born and raised in St. Louis. Hmm. And from the time I could remember, we go back and visit aunts and uncles and my grandparents and stuff. They always took me to a Cardinal game. And then I had the fortunate experience of living in St. Louis for about a year and a half, and my company having season tickets, third row behind the home on deck circle. And a lot of times they, you know, it's 80, you're talking about 81 home games, not counting any kind of postseason. So they gave me tickets frequently, especially if it was a day game. They're like, hey, you know, you've been working a lot of hours. Why don't you go down, catch the game, and then come back? You know, I worked like 3 miles from the stadium. So it was great. It was great. And I just, I love them. This year has been kind of weird because they were projected to be one of the best teams in the National League, and they got off to like their worst start in history, going 10-24 and falling like 14 games out of first place. But since then they've turned it around. They won 7 of 8. So I'm hoping everything's starting to click now. It's got a long way to go, but I'm hoping it clicks.
Yeah, sweet. If I had to be pinned down, I would say I'm an Orioles fan. I mean, I live in Baltimore City. I'm from Baltimore. But also, as an avid Caps fan, I do have a Washington Nationals hat. I don't fully know if, like, those two things are allowed to coexist or not. But
Well, I'll tell you something that I don't know if you knew or not, but you say the Baltimore Orioles, they actually used to be in St. Louis with the Browns for a long time, for, gosh, 60, 70 years. And they shared a ballpark with the Cardinals as well. And then they moved to Baltimore and became the Orioles.
Yeah, I did not know that. But now I did. Thanks. Well, there we go. Well, like other people, like Pete Enns is a huge baseball fan, so he'll be happy that that baseball came up in conversation.
That's not real baseball.
That's
not real baseball.
Yeah.
Yeah, they buy their teams. So.
Yeah, you heard it here first, Pete Enns.
They let other people develop the players and then buy them. Yeah.
Cool. Well, here, all right. I'll shift my metaphor I was going to use to baseball on your behalf. As an Orioles fan, I might say that I, based off their record and the little that I know about them, I don't believe that the Orioles are going to win the World Series this year. However, I have faith that they're going to. Yes. And I think, yeah, that sports metaphor like works for me for whatever reason.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One is really kind of, I guess, looking at the logic and the stats and the information and coming to a belief. And the other one is just like, it doesn't really matter what the belief is. This is what my gut tells me. It can happen, right? And I want it to happen. So I have that hope, and that hope drives my faith, and my faith drives my hope, right?
100%. Nailed it. All right. Cool. All right. Well, so I have, I want to bring in one more cultural example that I think is really interesting. And then I want to kind of tie in two things that I found interesting about like your own story. And like kind of a point that you bring up, and then kind of like wrap things up from there. Sound good?
Okay. Yep.
Sweet. All right. So cultural example. You bring in a quote from a book that when I read it first, I was in seventh grade and I did not appreciate it at the time. In fact, the teacher asked, who is enjoying the book so far? And people raised their hand. And then she asked, who is not liking the book so far? And myself and one other student, Dakota, raised our hands and we got kicked out of class. It was like, you asked me. Anyway, the book that much more now I appreciate is To Kill a Mockingbird. And the quote you bring up is wonderful. It's one of my favorite quotes in regards to this topic, but it kind of goes like this. It says, sometimes the Bible in the hand of one man is worse than a whiskey bottle in the hand of another. They're just some kind of men who are so busy worrying about the next world that they never learn to live in this one.
Yes.
And part of why I think that quote is so provocative and why I like it is because I think it rings deeply true for me. Oftentimes we can kind of get caught up in this, you know, argument is how real is it not, what's heaven, what isn't heaven, etc., that we forget to be here. So I'm just interested in why that quote kind of speaks to you, and where you kind of take that within your own life of faith.
Yeah, so to me it speaks to me that it's twofold, right? I'm using it in the context of you know, how it's a part of the cultural aspect of hell, but it's also about, you know, the line that you just said, you know, that the Bible basically can be just as bad as a whiskey bottle in someone else's hand. I've had that done to me enough. I've had that done to me enough to where someone just wanted to use that as a weapon. And so I read that part, and that part is what pulled me in. But then I continued to read and I thought, oh, well, this actually all fits with the idea of I'm trying to get across here. But it was that first part really that captured my attention, just because that had been some experience myself. And also, if he was still alive, he'd be upset that I was saying this. But my father, he was an alcoholic. He did finally quit several years before he passed away. But growing up, he drank a lot. He wasn't a violent drunk, but he got drunk every day nonetheless. But he was always kind. He always went to work every day. He always made sure our bills were paid. He always made sure we had all of our needs met. So we had this guy who did have a bottle in his hand, but he still took care of us. And I had another guy who talked all nice to me until I disagreed with him. Anyone smacked me with the Bible. So, it had some personal, I guess, connotations to it as well. Yeah. Sorry, Dad, if you hear me up there, sorry for telling people. My dad was a very, very private person. And so if he was around, he'd probably be already beating on my door saying, "What are you doing?" So.
Oh, well, thanks for sharing that, Sean. I appreciate that. I find myself, in your story and just having some similar experiences. And I don't know. I think it's always interesting how some of the, I just think about my experience of going from being a pastor to a brewer and working in a bar, which plays into your story, somewhat, perhaps in, somewhat of a negative way, because I become a, enabler in this regard. But
if I can sidetrack you again, though,
go for it.
That's another reason that I've enjoyed your podcast is hearing about the brewing, and that's also what I like hearing when I'm listening to Trip. You're right, homebrew Christianity, right? I had this idea after kind of getting into church and kind of into theology. I had this idea that I wanted to meet people in breweries and sit down and have conversations with them about worldviews. It didn't matter what their faith or lack of faith is. Let's just talk about it and let's learn from each other and let's grow. I thought it was a unique idea. And then I started searching and found out lots of people do this and typically call it like pub theology. But I actually called it other sheep, as in I have other sheep, not of this fold, that I must bring along. So it was all these other people. And I started a little group from that, and we met for a long time. COVID kind of changed the dynamics of everything, but we met every Thursday for a long time in a little brewery. And I, for a while, was keeping track of people who would just sit down with us. I just jotted their name down, and it was like over 60 different people at one point had just sat down with a small group of mine and talked about what they think about God or they don't think about God. And I loved it. Loved every minute of it while enjoying a nice beer.
I love it. Yeah. Beer, when, within a proper context, really one thing I love about it is it has such a way of bringing people together, regardless of what they think, believe, look like, talk like, etc. And that's, kind of cool. The place that I'm at now, Union, their like tagline is "Beer Unites," and I was like, "Pretty cool. I like it." Yeah. And so I dig that. But, ultimately, I had a similar experience to you, as where in like this place, where there's like beer and people are drinking, etc. I found like love and acceptance and community and people who cared about me and cared about my story and told me when I was being stupid, but also cheered me on when I was doing good. It's like, this is so cool. That kind of resonated with me. And then one other thing in your story that you share in the book, that I thought was interesting is there are two points I kind of want to tie together. One of them that you bring up is that like eternal conscious torment is not an effective deterrent from people doing bad stuff. Like, even though many, many people within the country believe eternal conscious torment to be true. There's still a lot of crime. People do shitty things all the time. And then I have thoughts about that, but I wanted to tie that into kind of, you make this point that like, if you were offered one of the differing views of hell outside of eternal conscious torment, you perhaps would have been drawn into the Christian faith much sooner than you were. And so I think those points kind of come together. And so I'll just be interested in what you'd have to say about that.
Okay. The first part about the deterrent, I didn't think about this until really right as you were saying it. But maybe part of my unconscious motivation too goes back to American capitalism in the sense that, you know, we have for-profit prisons. So there's an issue there too. And that also might be why we have more people in the prison system than any other country in the world. But that said, people are still doing bad things, right? And so you got this huge percentage of the population who believes hell is a real place, but they, big chunk of them obviously don't care that it's a real place. Or they think, well, I have time. I have time to reconcile what I've done. I'll have time to apologize. I'll have time. God will forgive me. He's going to love me anyway. I have time. And then the second part of that would be that when you're thinking about people in prison, right? So like our church has a jail ministry. I have not been a part of it. I've not went, but my wife has. They kind of do it separate. They have the women and then they have the men on different nights. And, you know, and it's, we've had a lot of people that show that interest and even that have gotten out, gotten released, and then they've attended our church, but some of them just disappear. And so it's, you know, it's almost just like, I'm going to do this now to make myself look good, or I'm going to, it gets me out of my cell for an hour or whatever the case may be. You know, I'm going to do these things now, but I don't really mean it. I think some do. I think some change. They do have a change of character, a change of heart, a change of their personality. But some of them aren't. And I think they use it as a tool to make themselves look in a better light than what they really are. And as far as if someone's telling me something different or showing me a different way, I think it has to do with this gut feeling I have about love. It goes back to that again. It goes back to that core value of love. Even though, again, I don't want to like sound like I'm just really beating up on myself, but I don't think I've done a really good job in my life at showing love like the way I believe it should be shown. But that is something I strive for. That's something I think about. That's something I pray about. Something I meditate about. And I think if someone would have told me, hey, you know, because God loves us, he's not going to torture you forever. But because he loves us, he's also not going to force you to do anything you don't want to do. So you can either go with him, or he's just going to let you be. He's going to let you go. He's going to let you disappear into nothingness. So that's why my gut says that's what really happens, even though my hope is universalism. So I just think if I would have heard those, or, you know, or if I would have been taught, if I would just been taught universalism, I probably wouldn't have listened to anybody else's view. I'd be like, oh yeah, that's the way it'll go. Let's do this. Right. But that was something that didn't come along for a long time. In fact, I think really, even though, you know, I don't think that's exactly what he was getting at, but many people interpret it that way. But Rob Bell with Love Wins, you know, I think that was kind of one of the first times for me that I was like, oh, well, maybe all of us can get there. Maybe we can all meet up at the same place, get to the same party at afterlife, right? But I think if I would have heard those at a younger age, it would have been different. I would have perceived Christianity differently. I would have perceived probably God differently. I would have perceived my friends and families and neighbors differently if I had just been taught that instead of, well, you done bad, so you're going to burn in hell.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it's so interesting because the kind of thought that I was having that ties into that is, you know, I think of my buddy Dan Koch, who does the You Have Permission podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Dan is currently, you know, studying and working on his PsyD to become like a you know, licensed psychologist and stuff. And
right.
He has talked about how when we, like as a psychologist, when you're looking to help somebody change behavior or core habits, etc., the way you do that is not by telling them like, hey, being a drunk all the time is bad and you are bad, or smoking too much, or like,
right.
I don't know, pick a negative habit that people perceive. Don't do that thing. You're bad, etc. The thing that actually changes people with from like a psychological perspective is to know that they are loved, that they are accepted, and that they belong. And then once people feel that they are loved, accepted, and belong, things happen.
Yes.
And transformation can take place. And so I don't know. I loved that point that you made, because I think so often I don't want to paint the whole church in this way, but the kind of Christianity, the kind of church that I grew up in was so focused on you suck, you're bad, you're wretched, you're a worm, etc., that is off-putting.
Right.
Or to put it, yeah, you know, this way, like Rob Bell has talked about how people are like, Rob, you're too positive, like you always tell people nice things. And he was like, look, I don't need to tell people that like I can be a bad husband, or that like I'm not always the best dad, because we know these things. People know that we do stupid,
yes,
stuff. They don't have to come to church to hear how they do stupid stuff. But
yes,
what they do need to hear, because it's not taught by capitalism, you know, capitalism, the whole point is like, you suck and we're going to fix you, you know,
yep,
is that you are loved, that you are accepted, that you belong. And perhaps if you want to go from a theistic perspective, the God of the universe knows your name, cares about you, and loves you. That's a whole different game. And like, I loved that point that you made there at the end of their chapter.
The way you just described it all, I mean, that was awesome. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking the phrase coming to mind to me was kill them with kindness. And you took it to a whole new level, right? I mean, because if you really, you know, and obviously you were referencing Dan, but you want some, if someone's really going to change, right, they're going to change based off of this positive behavior that you gave them instead of telling them they're a worthless piece of crap. Right. And so that's, you truly kill them. You kill who they were by being kind to them, and they're reborn as someone else. And, but the way you described all that, I'm like, yes, yes, exactly.
Ah, cool. Well, I guess my final question to you would be just like, is there anything that maybe we haven't talked about, or perhaps some kind of, I don't know if benediction is the right word, but a way that you would like to end our conversation, kind of a final word to our listeners to wrap up our time together today?
Just, I guess my advice to any listener is to just be open. Be open to hearing other views. You don't have to agree with everybody. You don't. But if you're open, you're going to learn something. You may teach them something, but you're going to learn something. And there's nothing wrong with learning and growing. So I think that would be my advice. Be open regardless what the topic is, right? Another one that's kind of relates to, eternal conscious torment and hell that I've thought a lot about is the doctrine of original sin. Right. We don't have time for me to go get into all that, but my point is, don't just take things at face value either. Right. Just because you've heard this, because someone has repeated it for hundreds of years or thousands of years doesn't mean you shouldn't look into it yourself and try to find out if you really believe that. So I would say, you know, be open, but also be curious. And so that's my advice. The last part I would want to say is I just really want to thank you. It was a great to say that I shared a book with you. I feel kind of like a kid here because I'm so excited. It's almost a small version of being like a starstruck or whatever, because I have listened to your podcast for so long. Right. So I'm just this guy sitting with my earbuds in, you know, walking around my park or whatever, listening to you talk and interview people. And now here I am on here with you. So it's kind of surreal to me. It's humbling. And, but I also definitely want to thank Chad. He put that faith in me, when he didn't even really know me. Right. I mean, we just had a couple email exchanges and I wrote a little review of his book, and he's like, yeah, you can do this. And I've already apologized to him 100 times, but I'll do it one more time here. And that I still don't think I wrote what he wanted me to write. He kind of gave me an idea, a topic that he wanted. And I thought I was going towards that. And when I gave him kind of a draft, he's like, yeah, I think maybe we ought to focus on what you're doing, so we don't mess up with your thought process and your flow. But he wanted it to be more of the effects from a pastoral role. So that you do see a little bit of element of that in there. I kind of tried to tie that in. But I think that he wanted that to be more of the emphasis more than this cultural view. But as he read my drafts and gave me feedback, I think he was on board with it too. He's like, yeah, this is a good perspective. So I thank him for not only inviting me to do it, having the faith to do it, but also given me that kind of freedom to use my own words. I felt like trying to write on a topic that someone else gave me, I didn't feel like it was me. I felt like I was trying to force something. So I think that's why my natural thoughts came out. And but I think it's great. And then, of course, Tom, if you listen to this, I want to thank you, because if it wasn't really somehow connecting with you, I wouldn't be connected with anybody else here. You've been a role model and you've been a good friend, really, and I appreciate it. So, and of course, all the other authors, I tell everybody, read all the chapters because they're all better than mine, including yours, Josh.
Ah, man. Well, Sean, this was so much fun. I really enjoyed it. And I don't know. Just to what you're just saying, I relate so much. Like, I always, I don't remember. I stole this language from, it might be from my friend Sari, but I always kind of felt like I'm theologian adjacent, like not really, you know, or like podcaster adjacent, something like that. And so like to be invited into a project like this was super exciting and a lot of fun. And I'm not convinced that I gave Chad what he was asking for, but he rolled with it, and I'm grateful for that. And also too, one more thing, just to kind of harp on what you wrapped up with there, is like, I think curiosity is maybe one of my favorite spiritual disciplines, if I can call it that. I think curiosity is just so important, and the role that curiosity has played in my own faith and my own continued journey of becoming, to kind of use some of the language I used on Rethinking Faith, has been something that has just been, you know, priceless. So I love the advice. Your chapter was great. I'm glad that it is what has been included in the book, even if it wasn't Chad's, you know, idea in general. I think it kicks ass. I enjoyed it. So
thank you. I do have two final things. One, if we ever cross paths again, just because of the way this conversation ended, and I'm gonna end up leaving you hanging by this, but we can talk again about Star Trek and the role it has played in my faith and worldviews. And the curiosity is what really made me think about that, is the I don't know. Anyway, we don't have time. The very last thing though, is who's going to interview you?
That's a good question. I think currently on the table is Chad, but offers are open, I guess. I don't know. So
tell Chad, hey, how about maybe I'll just bug Chad and say, hey, let's co-host it against Jock here.
Ah, there we go. That'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think so too.
Bother him. It sounds like a great idea.
Right on.
Oh, man. All right. Well, Sean, it was so nice to meet you, man. Thank you so much for your contributions. And hopefully our paths cross again. I enjoyed this conversation. And thanks for hanging out. And listeners, thanks for hanging out with us as well. Hopefully this conversation was as fun for you guys as it was for myself. So, cool. Sean, thank you so much.
It was for me. Thank you.
Sick. And listeners, go in peace.